Welcome. I'm Ben Shaw, and this is Out the Gate, a podcast about sailing and adventure on and around San Francisco Bay. So I met today's guest, Randall Reeves, last year when I was living aboard and circumnavigating the bay in a 10-foot dinghy. My story about that adventure is going to be published this spring in Cruising World, and I'll talk more about that trip when the article comes out. But I met Randall at the KKMI boatyard in Richmond, California. He was getting his boat, Moley, ready for a first-of-its-kind solo circumnavigation of both the Americas and Antarctic continents. It's a very ambitious trip, but Randall's really prepared, and he has a great boat, great attitude. Plus, he's really just a great guy. When I met him, despite his rush to get everything ready for his imminent departure, he took his time to make me feel welcome, allowing me to tie my little dinghy alongside his 45-foot aluminum sloop, and even though he hardly knew me, giving me a bunk to sleep in for the night. Randall's currently in the middle of his second attempt at what he calls the Figure 8 Voyage, a trip that's going to take him around Cape Horn twice, then up through the Northwest Passage before returning here to San Francisco. He left San Francisco last September, and when we spoke, he'd been at sea alone for 123 days. He and Moley were nearly due south of Tasmania when we talked. You can follow Randall's adventure at figure8voyage.com. That's figure, the number 8, voyage.com. He has a tracker there so you can see exactly where he is now. And he also writes a daily blog with pictures and videos. It's just fantastic. Now, the audio for this interview is not great because it was done over a satellite phone, but it's really pretty amazing that we could talk at all considering his location. So, jump aboard Moley and enjoy this interview. Well, congratulations on making it to over 100 days now.
Well, thank you. Yes, 123 days at sea as of today, and yeah, it's a long time. I left San Francisco on Figure 8 Voyage 2.0 back in October, and have been making good progress down around the bottom of the world. We're, what is it now, 9,000 miles past Cape Horn, so probably another 7,000 miles to get back to Cape Horn, so making good time, Ben.
Paint us a picture. What's happening right now? You wake up. What's your routine?
So day 123 out of San Francisco, I am at 46 south and 144 east. I'm about 200 miles south and a little bit west of Tasmania, which is that big island underneath Australia to the west, to the east. So we're about two-thirds of the way around the Southern Ocean. I'm heading east. My next waypoint is South Island of Australia. I need to go below to get back into the Pacific, headed toward Cape Horn. Day in the life, pretty active today and yesterday and going into the next week. We have very active weather, not gales, but very changing, but for the duration of our conversation, winds will go from 10 to 25 from northwest to north-northwest, and so wind on the quarter, so Mohan's a bit of a difficult time with the big seas. We've got like 10-foot seas, starting to see some break. There's a lot of 25 kind of move toward 30. There are front moving through right now, but we'll have the actual low-pressure system, which is in back of it, will start moving through in a couple of hours. I usually get up at 6 almost every morning, however much I've slept at night, a lot or a little. I'm usually up at 6 to start making notations in the log and to make sure we're headed in the right direction. Today's been pretty good. We've got this building weather system coming in, but, whoa, hang on there.
Was that whoa we just heard, a wave, or was that a puff of wind, or what do we got going on?
The seas are starting to build, and I'm taking them on the quarter. So the boat lifts up and then slides down a little bit sideways, and that one slapped us a little bit and knocked the mow over knocked her over a little bit, and I had to hang on to the railing here in the pilot house. No big deal, but it is, you know, life on a boat. You're always hanging on with at least four hands. Typical Southern Ocean weather, cold, rainy, dark. The only sign of life around is that I have birds that are near the boat almost constantly.
The only company is the birds, but you've got Monty there as well, your trusty self-steering vane that you write about a lot. You have conversations with Monty in your blog. Do you have conversations with Monty in person there?
I do. They're not quite as colorful as they are on the blog. The conversations with Monty in person are, will you please steer the boat in the direction I wish you to go? It's interesting, when you're alone, for as long as I've been alone, you start to invest personality in things on the boat, and the boat itself or the wind vane or the autopilot or the sails take on a kind of a personality of their own. There aren't any other personalities in which to invest that kind of emotion.
When do you feel most alone?
It varies for me. And, you know, this is the longest passage I've ever made. We're 123 days. I'm about halfway, roughly. So I've got another 120 or so ahead of me. You know, I've done a lot of solo sailing by this point. A lot of solo sailing before the Figure 8 attempt last year. Probably 30,000, 40,000 miles, 4, 5, 6 ocean passages all told. And then we have last year's Figure 8 voyage attempt, which didn't work, right? And I sailed home. I did circumnavigation. It's a little surprising, I guess, for me to get into the kind of the deeper ranges of this voyage as I am now, and starting to feel isolated, starting to feel alone. It's a little less of the problem now than it was when I was actually on the opposite side of the world from you. You being San Francisco, where my wife also is. There was something very dark about being literally 12 hours on the other side of the planet, on the dark side of the planet, as it were, from my wife and from my family. That was difficult. But it's come around. You put one foot in front of the other. Keep the boat going east as best you can. Keep yourself fed. You keep yourself in warm clothes. You try to sleep as much as you can. And you just keep going. You remember that it's a voyage, and all voyages have an end. And things have changed. So I don't know what really has changed over the last month or so, but I feel less isolated. I think part of it is that we're doing very well, making very good time.
It must be difficult being near Hobart, where you were about 10 months ago and had to pull in when you had some difficulties last time around.
Oh, man. I have never felt so homesick for a place I've only visited one time in my life. So, you know, we should back up. Let me just make sure that people know what we're talking about relative to the Figure 8 voyage. So what I'm attempting to do, I'm trying to sail around the world, trying to go around the world by the high latitude. So I leave San Francisco, I sail all the way down to the bottom of the world, to the bottom of South America, to Cape Horn, make a hard left turn, and then go all the way around the Southern Ocean. So below South America, below Africa, below Australia, back to Cape Horn, go under Cape Horn again, make a left turn and go up the Atlantic, all the way up into the Arctic, up into Davis Strait, way, way up by Greenland, make a hard left there, go across the top of Canada, across the top of Alaska, down to the Bering Sea, through the Aleutian Gulf of Alaska, and back home. It's about 40,000 miles of sailing, and I'm trying to do it all by myself and in 1 year. Depending on the day, I'm not sure which of those two is the most difficult, the solo part or the one-year part. It's a real timing game. Because the weather down in the Southern Ocean, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, is very temperamental, and the wind blows very hard. Average wind speeds are 25, 30 knots, and you get a gale about every week and a half. I left in October of 2017. That was attempt number one. Off the coast of Chile, on day roughly, let's call it day 60, I lost both self-steering devices. I use a monitor, self-steering wind vane, and as backup, I have a really robust autopilot, and they both quit on me about 400 miles offshore down at about 55 degrees south. So I had to hand steer the boat for a week into Ushuaia. It was a really, really difficult week. And it was in Ushuaia for about 2 weeks, effecting repairs, and then departed to continue the Figure 8. And then below Madagascar, in a little group of islands called the Crozets, down at about 45 degrees south, we were overtaken by a massive gale, unbelievable seas. It literally picked this boat up, threw it down on its side. It must have been a 20-foot sea. It was breaking for almost as far as you can see. I mean, if you go down to Ocean Beach and look at those breaking seas down there, bring some bad weather. That's kind of what it looked like down there by the Crozet. So threw the boat down, broke a window, filled the boat full of water. Unfortunately, the window was right above the nav station, so drowned most of my electronics, and that's what did me in. Lost my chart plotter, although I had a backup. Radios, I had no way to get weather, no comms. So I headed to Hobart. Hobart was about a month on. Basically rebuilt the boat there over the course of a month or two, and had a wonderful experience in Hobart. I loved it. Beautiful city, lovely people. I met a lot of great people that are still friends of mine. The meat pies and the sausage rolls in Hobart are just to die for. And so, yeah, the call to Hobart, the temptation to invent a reason to stop in Hobart is very large. But no, this is a nonstop venture. So we are continuing on past Hobart, under New Zealand, and back to Cape Horn.
What were some of the major lessons learned from the first attempt?
I think the first failures, the autopilot failure and the wind vane failure were, in a certain sense, it was kind of bad luck. The autopilot failure happened right after a big low pressure system. I had standing 50 knots gusting 70 for about 3 hours, and then it kind of tailed off to just, you know, good old fashioned blowing hard gale. And at the end of that low, we got knocked down such that it took a little bit of water, just a little bit of water into the main cabin here. And somehow that little bit of water found its way through the cushions and the bulkhead and the cabinetry and found its way onto the autopilot brain, which is right here next to the aft bulkhead where the hatch is, and knocked it out. It still baffled me how the water made it all the way through there, but it did. And the autopilot brain was old, not waterproof at all. The wind vane breakage was just odd. I broke a non-serviceable part. One of the things I love about the monitor is you can fix pretty much anything. I mean, everything's going to break at sea at some point. So you want to make sure that you have stuff on board that you know how to repair. And the lovely thing about the monitor is I can fix most everything. But what broke is a welded part on the pendulum. We're still trying to figure out why that happened. I think lessons there were, what Letessier used to say about low pressure systems and gales. It's really that last third of the low pressure system that you're most worried about, because by that point the sea's mature, and as the low pressure system begins to move out, the pressure of the wind on the waves is lessened and they start to stack up. And that's what happened when I got water in a boat that knocked out the autopilot. That's what it was. It was that last third of the low pressure really started to knock the boat around. So I learned to pay attention to that for sure. The gale that knocked us down and broke a window in the Indian Ocean was quite a different thing. There, it was the strange thing was that the winds were not as high as we'd seen elsewhere, 35, 45 knots, maybe gusting 50, but the seas were tremendous. It's super hard to judge wave height when you're at sea, but I'd say 20, 25. It wasn't the height of the sea so much as the fact that they were breaking and long, continuous breaks, for 100, 200 feet wide. So yeah, I remember watching it come on and thinking, well, it's a matter of time, because there was just no way of escaping breaking sea. So and after a while, yes, we got hit pretty hard. I would say probably right at the top of the low pressures, we got hit, knocked down, broke a window. I think what I learned there was that I wasn't letting Mo run fast enough. I was carrying a storm jib in 35, 40, 45, which is not very much sail, and we weren't going fast enough, and what was occurring was that Mo was coming down the front of a sea and getting to the bottom and kind of stalling out a little bit because she didn't have enough lay on her, and the wind vane just could not keep the boat straight. That's a working theory then, which I am testing on Figure 8 Voyage number 2. So far, it's worked out okay. I haven't had the storm jib out once. I've kept the working jib up. I roll it up and roll it up, but I keep boat speed up, try to keep it 6, 7, 8 knots so that the wind vane has a lot of power. We got hit pretty hard about 2 weeks ago. We're in the latter part of the low where I tacked around trying to take the new wave train at a better angle. We got thrown down pretty hard, got a lot of water in the boat. So we were going fast at that point, so my more speed theory isn't 100% right on, but I think for the most part it's really helped.
Tell me about how you first got to love the sea and love sailing.
I was in high school when my father bought our first sailboat, the Hunter 130 sloop. And we were living in Stockton, California, which is about 70 miles up the river from San Francisco Bay. San Francisco Bay, then up the San Joaquin River. And you get to a deep water port called Stockton. And I distinctly recall that first afternoon on the river, tacking down river, because that's all you do is you tack down river and sail downwind home. That's all it is. Very narrow. But I just remember that feeling, the boat leaning, heeling over, and catching the wind and charging off. And that just bit me really hard. That was a very formative afternoon in hindsight. And from there, it was kind of downhill. I learned pretty quickly that I not only liked sailing, but I liked doing everything. I liked running the boat myself. I had a very bad habit of when my father went away on business trips, it took him out of town and out of state often, I would find an excuse to skip school and borrow the boat for an afternoon and sometimes for entire weekends. I got down as far as Antioch one time, and I got down to San Francisco Bay a couple of times, tacking there in front of the Golden Gate Bridge, thinking, gosh, I would really love to go out to sea, but of course it wasn't my boat at that point, so I guess it probably was smart, but I didn't have the guts. So that's how I learned to sail, and that was really the attraction. I think through Matessier, really learning to be attracted to the ocean, to blue water sailing, and to single handing, that's where I learned that attraction. I didn't really get to it. I think I made my first ocean crossing by myself in 2010. So all of the solo single handing that I've done has really been since then.
Tell me about your memories of sailing down to San Francisco Bay for the first time.
Well, it was so different, right? My entire sailing world was the river. The river was at its widest, probably an eighth of a mile. And so all of your experiences of sailing on the river are tack, 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 and run, tack, 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 and run. So getting down to San Francisco, getting past Carquinez and then past the San Rafael Bridge into the main bay, man, it's rough to a river sailor out there. And it just really grabbed my attention. The water changes color. It becomes that emerald green as opposed to brown. And it's really windy and it's really cold. It was so enlivening. That was my first experience of San Francisco Bay. I think probably in hindsight, that was what really made me want to move to San Francisco, was that experience of San Francisco Bay.
What do you love about San Francisco Bay? I know we've talked a little bit in the past about you love using it as a cruising ground.
My own focuses as a sailor have been on single-handing and cruising as opposed to racing. I don't belong to a yacht club. I don't do the beer can races and stuff like that. They're lovely, and I'm sure they're fun, but it's just not my thing. My thing is about exploration. You know, my heroes are guys like Patessia and the explorers like Cook and Sir Francis Drake and people like that. That's where the fantasy lies for me. So I really have used San Francisco as kind of a practice ground for cruising. You know, my wife and I would spend weekends on our little boat, the Mariner I called Murr. And we'd go out and anchor and hike, you know, China Camp, Paradise Cove, behind Belvedere, Angel Island, Aquatic Park, just some really awesome places to hang out. And unlike a lot of other bays in the world, they give you access to open space. And China Camp and Paradise Cove in particular give you access to great, great hiking. So our pattern for years was to, on the summer weekends, head out, camp out on the boat, essentially, and hike during the day, come back to the boat, and sleep at night, go to a different anchorage, hike the next day, et cetera. And then I got it into my head one week that I'd like to do a hike trek exercise. So I did what I called China to Paradise. So I'd sail from Sausalito down to Paradise Cove, so the backside of Tiburon, and drop a dinghy there with a note that says, please don't steal my dinghy because I'll need it tomorrow. Then get back in the boat with the second dinghy, sail down to China Camp, anchor overnight, leave the boat there, row ashore, tie the dinghy with another note saying, please don't molest my dinghy, and then hike from China Camp over the ridgetops back to Paradise Cove. It turns out to be roughly a marathon. It's about 23 miles, so a long hike. I think I started at 6 a.m. and I didn't get back to Paradise Cove until late afternoon. Of course, you had to time it on the tide because I needed to row from Paradise Cove back to China Camp, and that was a long day. That was I was pooped by the time I got done. It's a great experience, a lot of fun, and kind of emblematic of what you can do in the San Francisco Bay if you kind of think it through. There's really a lot of multi-use kind of activities you can do in San Francisco Bay.
That's fantastic. I love that. That's a finding adventure right here on the bay. I mean, we first met when I was actually taking a small dinghy and sailing it around the bay, and you were kind enough to let me tie up alongside Mo at KKMI. Yeah, that was wonderful. I mean, what was so fabulous about that, just like you said, is you can make these adventures wherever you are, whether you're having an amazing adventure that few people get to sail the Southern Ocean or circumnavigate Antarctica, but you can have adventures wherever you are.
It's true, but I think I certainly learned how to sail in San Francisco Bay. San Francisco Bay is hard, right? You've got in certain parts of the bay, you've got lots of wind. In certain parts of the bay, you've got no wind. You've got rough water in certain parts and flat water in other parts. Lots of tide and no tide. So there's a lot of variety in the bay, and it requires a lot of technique to just get from one place to the other. So it's a great training ground for cruising. Some people say you can sail San Francisco Bay, you can sail anywhere. Not quite true, but it's a good phrase, and I know what it means. And there's a lot of truth in it. But so San Francisco is great in that regard. But then you add on top of that that people in the Bay Area value open space. I remember my first discovery of, Golden Gate National Recreation Area up there above San Francisco, Golden Gate Park. I was just blown away. I had never experienced anything like that. Point Reyes, amazing. Who sets aside, a piece of land 50 miles long, 50 miles wide, out there in the middle of nowhere? Oh, just amazing. So you can actually, you can sail around the perimeter of the bay as you did in your dinghy, which is an awesome adventure, or you can hike around it. And there's just so much for a person who enjoys being outdoors. There's just a ton of opportunity in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Because I know you have a routine when you come back to San Francisco. Can you talk about that a little bit when you sail back? You've done it multiple times now.
So I live a very urban life. I've lived in San Francisco since 1989. Just recently moved to Oakland. It's extraordinarily different from being by yourself on a small boat on the ocean. So I have tended, when I finish a cruise, when I'm headed back to San Francisco, I have tended to stop at Drake's Bay in Point Reyes for a day or two and just kind of not decompress, but I guess recompress and just kind of get used to the idea of being back in civilization. It can be extremely strange to come in off the ocean, head to a marina, and have your next activity be to get in a car that gets on a 6-lane freeway. That is just weird. So I try to soften the blow a little bit by pulling into Drake's Bay, and I love the whole Point Reyes area. And again, we talk about access to open space. You can anchor Drake's Bay and do infinite hiking up there. It's a beautiful place. I've spent years going to Point Reyes, so it kind of has a special place in my heart. My way of kind of reconnecting with California before I have to reconnect with San Francisco.
You have a lot of supporters here in the Bay Area who are following your progress. Of course, many followers all around the world. But do you have anything that you want to say to those listening to San Francisco?
Well, thank you. For one thing, I really appreciate the support. This is the first time this cruise, the last couple of months, where I've had Joanna send me comments from the website and I can respond to some of them. And that's actually been a lot of fun for me. So it's neat to see people interacting with the website. It's neat to see people interested in the voyage. I know why I'm interested in the figure eight, but the fact that other people are interested in the figure eight is kind of surprising, actually. So thank you, number one. And specifically to the virtual voyagers, I'd like to say thank you. So, you've seen the site, you've been on the site, that I post a report every day from sea. It comes along with pictures. And then every week or two, I post a video report or just moving pictures of where I am. That's pretty unprecedented for a private yacht. The big boys, the big racers, the corporate race boats have that. People with a lot of money have that. I'm not one of those. One of my goals for the figure eight was to really bring people along in a real-time way as possible. I asked before the first figure eight for contributions on the GoFundMe site for people to help me with the technology that I'd need be able to send pictures and video. It's very available. It's also very expensive, both in terms of just buying the hardware and then the data. So a lot of money was invested there by Virtual Voyagers, who helped me pay for the first go-round of data and technology for the pictures and videos. And then we did a second campaign for the second one. Thank you very much for that. And if people are interested and find fun and value in what I'm doing in the figure eight, it's an expensive endeavor, so would love contributions and help and to the degree that people seem fit. The website where you can find me, find the boat, I have a tracker as well that updates every hour, my position, my speed, my course, along with weather overlay from Windy TV. So a very dynamic tracker is all at figure8voyage.com. That's figure8voyage.com. I update every single day. It's getting pretty rough here. The wind shifted and the boat's starting to get thrown around, so I should probably get back to work. But I really appreciate your time. Thanks for the interest in it. And, you know, one of the things you miss when you're alone so long is just having a conversation with somebody. So thanks for the interest, and it's been a lot of fun to just talk to you.
Well, it was a treat for me, and I'm sure it will be for everybody who's listening, and just want to wish you fair winds and best of luck on the rest of the trip. May it continue going as well as it's been going, and we'll follow your progress closely.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Appreciate the follow, appreciate the support, and especially from people like your lovely daughter, who has a big map on the wall where you track my position for her. I think that's just awesome. Thanks for sharing that photo, and thanks for being engaged in the Figure Eight Voyage in that way is really meaningful to me. So thanks for doing that, Ben.
Of course. She's one of your biggest fans, and we'll both be there waving when you sail under the Golden Gate again.
Hey, excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. I look forward to it. In several months, let's say probably November, okay?
We'll be there.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode of Out the Gate. Again, if you want to follow Randall's adventures, visit his site at figure8voyage.com. He's a really good writer. Personally, I look forward to his daily blog posts. He writes about everything from baking bread to storm tactics to the beauty of being out there. Visit the site, become a virtual stowaway, as Randall calls it, and follow his adventure. Thanks again for listening. I'm Ben Shaw.